Welcome to Politics and Reality Radio. I'm Joshua Holland. This week, we'll talk to Heather Digby Parton about Russiagate, the firing of FBI Director James Comey, and Trump's subsequent complete meltdown. Then we'll be joined by Andy Slavitt, who ran the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services under Obama. We'll look at a pretty innovative tactic that's popped up in the debate over Obamacare repeal. And finally, we'll speak with Carolyn Isaacs. She's the director of the American Friends Service Committee's Tucson office, and she'll tell us about what's really going on in our southern border. First, a couple of items you may have missed. Donald Trump appears to be leaning toward appointing Sam Clovis to be the country's top scientist. That is the head of the USDA's research section. The only problem is that Clovis isn't a scientist. He's a conservative talk radio host and a big-time Trump supporter. He's also a climate change-denying crackpot. This is not normal. This guy is going to oversee all sorts of vital research, federally funded research. The law, according to ProPublica, states that the job should be filled, and I quote, from among distinguished scientists with specialized or significant experience in agricultural research, education, and economics. So that's happening. According to multiple reports, Donald Trump is becoming increasingly isolated and erratic and is obsessed with the leaks coming out of his White House. By the way, Republicans in Congress seem to be similarly obsessed, more concerned about the leaks about the White House's dysfunction than the White House's dysfunction itself. And I notice with some pleasure that all of these stories about Trump freaking out about leaks are followed by a paragraph like this one from a recent AP piece. This was published on Saturday. It reads, and I quote, "A dozen White House officials and others close to Trump detailed the president's decision-making and his mood on the condition of anonymity in order to discuss private conversations and deliberations." So every time there's a story about Trump freaking out about leaks, there is, a dozen different people leaking, and that's just delicious. Less delicious, ABC News reports, and I quote, "In a sharp reversal, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency has cleared a way for a company to seek permits to develop a massive copper and gold deposit near the headwaters of a world-class salmon fishery in southwest Alaska. An earlier EPA study had," and again I quote, "concluded that large-scale mining posed significant risk to salmon in the Bristol Bay region and could adversely affect Alaska natives in the region whose culture is built around salmon." In other news, Oklahoma State Rep. Mike Ritzy, a Republican, obviously proposed that the state address a budget shortfall by turning school kids who don't speak English over to ICE. It's unconstitutional and perverse, but that's where we are today. And I would just note the casual racism of assuming that those who don't speak English as a first language are undocumented immigrants. Speaking of economic anxiety, yet another study found that bigotry predicted whites' support for Donald Trump. According to an analysis of post-election data by the Public Religion Research Institute and The Atlantic magazine, and I quote, "Evidence suggests financially troubled voters in the white working class were more likely to prefer Clinton over Trump. Besides partisan affiliation, it was cultural anxiety, feeling like a stranger in America, supporting the deportation of immigrants, and hesitating about educational investment that best predicted support for Trump." Now, this must be the 8th or 9th study to find the same results. But, of course, we will continue to hear all about how it was NAFTA, right? It was offshoring and robots and economic insecurity. When something becomes conventional wisdom, it's just very, very hard to shake. So these studies can keep coming out. I don't think it's going to change the narrative. And on that happy note, let's move along with the show. We'll take a quick break, and then we'll be right back with Digby. Stay tuned. Welcome back. I'm still Joshua Holland. I am always happy to welcome Heather Parton to the show. You may know Heather better as Digby. She writes a column for Salon, and of course she blogs at her place, Hullabaloo. Hi, Heather. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, Joshua.
According to reports, Trump was obsessed with the Russian probes, plural, and also with leaks from his White House. So he didn't tell anyone but a close circle of longtime advisors that he was going to fire FBI Director James Comey. They told him, oddly, they told him that everyone would greet him as a liberator, I guess, because Dems were angry that Comey basically threw the election to Trump. And it's all blown up in spectacular fashion. Have you ever seen anything like this past week? I was only three when Watergate went down, but it's certainly crazier than Iran-Contra.
Oh, it's crazier than Watergate, to be honest, because, I mean, I was a little older than three, although I wasn't, you know, that old, but I was old enough to follow it. I was in high school. And I do remember it, and it unfolded slowly at first and gathered steam. And then finally, you know, you remember Watergate broke before Nixon was elected in
before
one of the greatest landslides.
Yeah,
in one of the greatest landslides in American history. I mean, he was really, I mean, he was elected with a huge mandate, unlike Donald Trump.
Isn't it really hard for Republicans to win the Electoral College?
I have heard that. I mean, except for the fact that, you know, they do have a tremendous advantage in the Electoral College. Other than that, it's really a difficult accomplishment. I wish I understood who told him that, because he keeps repeating it, and it's like everybody's rolling that knows is rolling their eyes going, what the hell is he talking about? But in any case, Watergate, I do remember how that unfolded. And it finally, you know, crescendoed in these hearings where, you know, you had John Dean talking about cancer on the presidency, and then Alexander Butterfield revealed the tapes. I mean, but this was a slow, you know, evolution of that story that finally kind of burst into a huge daily story where you tuned into the news every night going, oh my God, what happened today? Of course, it's very different with today's news media and social media and everything. But, this is a different level altogether. I mean, even as much as you might have, I mean, Richard Nixon was a malevolent, evil man. And he had committed some very, very serious crimes in terms of executing the war, which he had promised to end, right? I mean,
yes.
The bombing of Cambodia and all this. So there was a tremendous reservoir of anger at him on a policy level, you know, toward him for what he had done as president. But no one doubted that he understood what the job of president was, or that he had a rudimentary grade school level knowledge of how the government worked.
Right.
Richard Nixon, for all of his malevolence, was a you know, what people would perceive as a competent steward of the, you know, the most powerful nation on earth, in terms of, at the very least, you know, understanding what he was doing.
Yes.
And you know, I don't think I've ever, until Trump, I mean, I had a slight inkling of this with George W. Bush, because he wasn't the sharpest tool in the shed. But this idea that somebody is in that job who is 100% clueless and is running around like a giant, you know, this vision of the giant toddler is one that always occurs to me.
Yeah.
They're just kind of bumping into walls and doesn't understand what he's doing. Well, that's what's creating this sense. It's not only of someone who is malevolent, which Trump is. I mean, I think he's a malevolent human being. He's a violent, kind of vicious, vengeful person, racist, you know, I mean, anything you want to say. But
yeah.
He's also completely uncontrolled, undisciplined, and unknowledgeable of what the basic function of the job is. And what we're seeing is how much our institutions can withstand something that crazy, as if an alien from a foreign planet had sort of been dropped into the job and tried to figure out how to do it. That's kind of what we're experiencing. And this is one of the most stressful things, you know, political events I've ever been through far more than Watergate, far more than Iran-Contra.
I've made this point before that about the stress, right? This presidency is a daily stressor for a large swath of the population. And it, you know, the president should mostly function in the background. We should be angry about certain policy issues, of course. But I mean, to every day wake up and wonder what the hell this guy's going to say or do is, it's just incredibly stressful. And you don't know. It's the erratic nature. I wonder, in some degree, Donald Trump is almost making me less ideological. I'm a person of the left. I have strong beliefs, but I have never really appreciated the importance of competence and basic understanding of what the job is and how to conduct yourself in that level of leadership. So the wheels really seem to be coming off the bus. You get all these leaks. People in the White House are incredibly freaked out, according to 8 million leaks. So far, though, Republicans seem to be holding fast, at least publicly. You do hear grumblings in private. And until Dems win some elections, that seems to be what matters. On the one hand, every week, two or three reporters draw the short straw and have to go to some rural town and ask dumb white people who voted for Trump if they still like him. And every week they produce two or three stories about how they still do and how they blame the media for distorting his awesome accomplishments. On the other hand, though, you mentioned this. Republicans stood with Nixon until late in the game and then only bailed when it became impossible to defend him. So will we see a tipping point? Where is that tipping point? Do they have to win a special election?
I don't even know if that will do it, to be honest. I kind of have a feeling that 2018 has to be the tipping point, the election in the midterm. With Nixon, it was revelations, right? It was this kind of rolling revelations that came up with, I mean, it finally became clear that he was basically, he was flouting the rule of law. I mean, we later found out he didn't say this at the time. It was later in interviews with David Frost that he said, when the president does it, it's not illegal. And he had taken that sort of view that the executive branch was exempt from the rule of law as we understood it. And that became obvious in Watergate. And you understood, you know, with the Saturday Night Massacre and him refusing to give over the tapes and taking it all the way to the Supreme Court. These were things that were startling to people. And the Republicans finally reached a point where it was like, we can't go along with that. Donald Trump's already blown past that. he's blown way past where Nixon already was at the zenith of his crisis.
Yes.
In terms of flouting the rule of law and being completely, I mean, you know, just with his emoluments and conflicts of interest issues, he's already said the president cannot have a conflict of interest. He
yes.
said it out loud. I mean, he doesn't just say, look, there's no law against doing what I'm doing. He says it that way. The president cannot have a conflict of interest. So, you know, he's already blown past that just on that side of it. Now, this whole Russia investigation and whatever is under there, and, you know, I don't know the extent of that, but something's happening, obviously, and his defensiveness about it only and cover-up, clearly, only makes people more suspicious. So,
I mean, look, he could not have thrown gas on the fire more clearly than he did with the Russia thing. By the way, it is interesting to me that everybody goes around, that there are people going around claiming that Democrats are obsessed with the Russia investigation when it's clearly the case that Trump, like, wakes up thinking about it. It's an all-consuming preoccupation for him. Could he have picked a fight? There's been a number of reports about FBI rank and file being just up in arms over his treatment of Comey. Not only the way he fired him, but the way he lied about it afterwards, the way he tried to blame officials in the Department of Justice for it, et cetera, et cetera. And there have been a few stories about how, you know, the FBI could wage war on Donald Trump, leaking things, redoubling their efforts in the Russian investigations, perhaps working more closely with Congress on their investigations. Did he bite more than he could chew with that?
Well, you know, I mean, all of that is troubling just in itself, right? I mean, nobody, I don't think any civil libertarian likes the idea of the FBI deciding that they are going to go to war with the president. You know, I mean, this is not a, obviously the stress on our institutions is even worse than it is on individuals like us, you know, who are, yes, who are watching this thing from afar. But, I mean, let's face facts, you know, on a purely practical level, is this surprising? I mean, here you have an agency, the FBI, which by all accounts was pretty, you know, I mean, the rank and file of the FBI, like all of law enforcement in the United States, thought Donald Trump was kind of a terrific guy. And apparently, yes, many of them voted for him. Many of them were extremely hostile to Hillary Clinton. And many of them were upset that James Comey did what he did. Now, there are various reasons for that. Some apparently thought he had, they were upset that he had abandoned the norms and the policy of the Justice Department in going out and holding his press conference and releasing the letter in late October, et cetera, et cetera. But a good many of them were upset with him because he decided not to indict Hillary Clinton. So it's not as if Donald Trump went into this with a, you know, with a hostile FBI that just hated his guts going in, at least not across the board. But firing the guy, you know, the head guy, and especially the way they did it, the total lack of dignity, just the crudeness with which Trump got rid of Comey, and then, of course, everything that's happened subsequently, you know, on a practical level, Trump should have known that this was not a good idea. No president who, and of course, Trump has never read a, I don't know if he's read a book, much less a, you know, a book of history. But, you know, president, there is a precedent for presidents having trouble with the FBI. Let's put it that way. There used to be a guy named J. Edgar Hoover who pretty, yes, much, you know, ran the country, yeah, for decades, holding, you know, because he had dirt on, you know, every powerful person in America. You know, the idea, I mean, this has always been a tension, right? I mean, you have this extremely powerful law enforcement agency, and their ability to affect politics has always been, you know, very, very possible in the right hands and under the right circumstances. So they tried to set up these walls, you know, these walls of independence and, you know, the 10-year term and all that stuff. Trump just, as he does with everything else, just barreled right into that without thinking about it, and now the rank and file is upset with him. And let's be clear here. He did the same thing with the intelligence community. Before, you know, during the transition, he called them Nazis.
It's rare. You know? It's very rare that you get the FBI and the CIA on the same page. Trump is a uniter in that sense that everybody in everybody in national security basically hates him. It is discomforting to see to think about the FBI getting involved in the political sphere on the one hand. On the other hand, these institutions do have to stand up to President Trump if we have any chance. So, yeah. You know, it is a government institution. It's troubling in the abstract. I'm not sure that it's that troubling in the specific in this case.
Well, I agree with you. And you know, again, that's another case where, just as you mentioned earlier, you know, you're less ideological than you used to be. You know, I'm finding myself this part of myself being tested as well, because, you know, I do consider Trump to be a clear and present danger. I mean, this is not politics as usual. It's not someone that I can just sort of sit there and go, well, you know, it's more important that we maintain the principle, you know, than the idea that this guy, what he's demonstrating for all to see is this authoritarian, fascistic, nationalistic strain that, and in the hands of someone that I think has no clear understanding of what any of that means and is easily able to just, you know, walk right into it without, you know, having even any kind of conscience or you know, sense of the massive kind of change that he's enacting when he does this stuff. The institutions are all we have, and of course, institutions are just people, right? I mean, they're not—they don't actually exist. They're the edifice within which a whole bunch of people do their jobs, and these institutions—if they don't fight back, we're screwed. I mean, we don't You know, we don't. We can protest and God help us, hopefully vote and be allowed to vote and have those votes counted. But these institutions are there, you know, for a reason. So yeah, I'm rooting for them to at least uphold their own dignity and patriotism and sense of right and wrong in this. And by the way, you mentioned this: the Republican institution, the institution of the Republican Party. Not exactly, you know, showing themselves to be, you know, have a whole lot of integrity at this point.
I was about to say that it's especially important that the bureaucratic institutions hold the line, because, you know, Congress is supposed to be the check, and it is not. It is clearly not a check on this presidency. Let me ask you this before we only have a couple more minutes. James Comey revealed through... I guess, I don't know who he talked to, which reporter he talked to, but he revealed that Donald Trump had met with him, had requested him to come to dinner, asked him to pledge his loyalty to Trump. It was a damaging story. Do you think that we're going to just kind of see Comey and his close associates leaking damaging stories through the midterms?
I do. And I think that I think Comey will end up going before Congress. I mean, the reports were that he had refused to appear before the committees in private, but that he said he would do it.
It had to be in
public testimony. Yeah.
Yes.
So that's actually, you know, a good sign. Look, I just to make it clear, I have never been a big fan of James Comey.
He's not someone I've been
extremely critical of him.
Yes.
And in fact, there's one thing that Trump said about Comey that I agree with. He is a showboat. And so in this case, in this sense, this may very well be a good thing, because he may be a person who's willing to come before the Congress and play the role that he has played over the years, which is, you know, this heroic man bucking the system and, you know, taking everything on his own shoulders to, you know, for truth and justice in the American way.
Yes.
In this sense, in this case, that may be what is necessary, is for some people to do that particular thing, which I always find kind of fatuous and ridiculous.
I agree.
In this case, it's you know, hey, I keep saying this, you know, it's not much, but it's all we've got. So, you know.
That's right. You got it.
Hopefully.
Let me also point out that it is absolutely not hypocritical to think that James Comey should have been fired for...
Yep.
His for violating protocol during the election, and also be appalled that he is fired in order to shut down an investigation.
Exactly.
Into the press.
Exactly. I don't know why that's controversial.
Contradictory here. There's nothing hypocritical here. It is extremely consistent, right? There's just It's just the dumbest talking point that I've seen in a while. It's really silly. Heather Parton, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. I really do appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Joshua.
Folks, stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break and then come right back.
Type of hoe. I treat a man like he treats me. The difference between a hooker and a hoe ain't nothing but the stress and the spite me. Now you could get with that or you could get with this, but I don't give a cause really it's none of your business.
1993, S&P, packing and macking, bamboozling and smacking suckers with this track and throw the beat back in.
I'm about to break before you understand that your double standards don't mean to me. I know exactly what you say when I turn and walk away, but that's okay because I don't let it get to me. Now every move I make, somebody's clocking. So ask me nothing, will you just leave me alone? Never mind who's the guy that I took home to bone.
Okay, Miss Thing never giving up skins. If you don't like him or his friends, what about that Benz? Your pet pep's got an ill rep with all that macaroni trap for rap. You better step, or better yet, get refuse to be played like a fitness and trick deck of cards. No, I ain't hard like the bitches on a boulevard. My face ain't scarred and I don't dance in bars. You can call me a tramp if you want to, but I remember the pump who just humped and dumped you. Or you can front if you have to, but everybody gets horny just like you. So, yo, ho, check it, double deck it, on a regular butt naked. Pep's ass gets respected, miss, but it's none of your business.
Welcome back to the show. I'm still Joshua Holland. My next guest knows a thing or two about Obamacare. Andy Slavitt played a key role in fixing the healthcare.gov website after its glitchy rollout. He went on to serve as acting director of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services under Obama, a position he held until Donald Trump came into office. He is currently a senior fellow at the Bipartisan Policy Center. Andy, welcome to Politics and Reality Radio.
Thanks for having me, Josh.
Thank you so much for taking the time, and I know you're on the road. I live in New York 19. Like many Republicans these days, my representative, John Faso, refuses to hold a town hall meeting with his constituents. He says it's more fruitful to meet in small groups, but his office has not responded to multiple requests I've made to participate in one of those meetings. But earlier this week, a Democratic member of Congress, Sean Maloney, who represents the 18th district next door, came to the 19th to hold a town hall of his own. It was a smart tactic in that it generated quite a lot of local media attention. First, Andy, what does it say about the health care bill that only 14 of the 217 members of Congress who voted for it are holding town halls during the recess?
That's curious. You know, I'm just coming from a town hall myself here in Arizona 2, which is served by Representative McSally. And I have offered to go to as many districts as I could to have a healthcare town hall for places that have, where they're not getting straight answers or any answers, and they have gotten yes votes from their members of Congress. And we had a pretty packed room, and I think what we heard is people that are frustrated that the promises that they think they are here, that they think they heard, to cover more people, to reduce the cost of health care, to protect people with pre-existing conditions, are all being broken. And I think I'm hearing that pretty much universally wherever I go. And I think it's no secret that if you felt good about this bill, you'd wait for a CBO analysis, you'd hold hearings, you'd have town halls, and you'd work to make it better. Tells me we don't have a Congress that's working in our best interest.
Yeah, it tells me the same thing. Now, shortly after Maloney announced that he was coming, I learned that there is this new thing called the Healthcare Town Hall Project. Andy, you're working on this project. What is it, and who is behind it?
It is a giant mammoth effort with me and one other person. It is like, you know, you're a buddy road warrior movie where we're driving to town halls. Local people are kind enough to organize them and arrange for them. We do some of them on the phone. I've also done some in Democratic districts with there the representatives actually show up, but in the Republican districts so far nobody has shown up. If you count the Facebook and the telephone, we've had over 3,000 people showing up at these town halls. And it's been incredible to hear people's personal stories, because healthcare is nothing but a series of accumulated personal stories. And we're just getting out there and hearing them and explaining to people the facts and how the proposed bill impacts their lives.
Now, I may have been misinformed because I was told that this was something that also was being organized by Indivisible, the group Indivisible, and the Center for American Progress. Is that a different effort?
Well, so we're leaning on anybody who can help us, and that's included Organizing for America. I believe it's included Indivisible. It's basically local groups that are helping us pull this together. Also, Protect Our Care. So there's a lot of, we're not doing anything unique. I wouldn't pretend that this is some unique idea, but we're trying to leverage the kinds of activities people might already be doing, because we can't, obviously the two of us can't organize all of these pieces. So there's a lot of these local chapters, as you point out, that are being very helpful.
I mean, I think that it is somewhat interesting to see that this is an example of kind of so-called resistance groups working with both the Democratic Party. You have representatives like Maloney involved in this, and also for what, for lack of a better word, might be called establishment organizations like the Center for American Progress. Do you think this is a one-off, or are we likely to see more of these kinds of inside-outside campaigns, if you will?
So I would probably be smarter at describing it if I were a millennial, because I think there's something that's going on that people who are more knowledgeable about social media and organizing get. But, when people like Rupert Murdoch, who I heard say the other day that he believes that this is a crazily organized, heavily organized bus campaign, he didn't say that where people were getting paid, but I think that was the implication.
Right.
And then you see it up close, and you're talking to someone who is literally on a highway between Tucson and Sierra Vista, another person, and you show up, and citizens are walking in. I mean, there are no buses there. These are citizens. I don't know if they voted for Trump. I don't know if they voted for Hillary Clinton. I do know that they're torqued that McSally has not faced them. I do know that they are moms and dads first, because the stories they told were about their family members and themselves and how they think they're going to be hurt by this. They have legitimate questions that their representative and their office should be answering for them. So I think what's happening is kind of this sort of, there's probably a morphed word between organic and web organizing that sort of melds together, where these cells form. And, my role in it is quite small. I would just show up and talk for an hour, but there's a really significant amount of energy that's already in these communities.
Now, you are driving from Arizona's 2nd. Ruben Gallego, who is a Democrat representing the 7th, was planning on holding a town hall there. And I should just note for listeners, Martha McSally was the one who reportedly told colleagues, "Let's effing do this," and she didn't say effing, before they voted on the AHCA. So everybody was kind of up in arms about her specifically.
That's one of the reasons I came here, is because the way I heard that was that this is a sport.
Yes.
This is a game. This is just a game to be won or lost without any consequence for people. And I tell you, I was with people from one of the best hospitals here in the district called Tucson Medical Center. And what they reported back to me and seeing the local press, as well as Uber drivers, all the same thing. People were deeply offended by that statement and that attitude, and the little peek in to how the momentum of DC just overwhelms the needs and interests of someone's district. And, I can't tell you the demographics or the numbers or whatever, but whoever's going to run against McSally is going to be greeted as a hero.
Yeah. So Gallego talked to the New Republic, and he said that in the past, it might have seemed rude or unstatesmanlike to go into another rep's district, but those norms no longer apply under Trump. And obviously Trump is somebody who has shown a tendency to blow up quite a few norms himself. Do you think that's a common view in the party, or is there still a sense that Dems should adhere to those norms regardless of what the other side does? Are we seeing a change in mindset?
Well, look, I'm quite sure that the people here would have much rather heard from the representative than someone who travels 1,624 miles to talk to them. I'm quite sure they would rather hear from the person that voted for them. So, and if she decides tomorrow to try to do a town hall, that should be, that's the right thing to do, and I hope she does it. But people have a lot of questions. They want to get educated. They need to hear from people that give them information that they can trust, that's useful. And so I don't think this is the breaking of a norm in a way that doesn't serve the public interest. The norms that are being broken by the White House are norms which say, hey, if someone puts out a fact that's got data behind it, let's just put out another fact, even if it's false, so people don't know what to believe. That's not a good norm to be broken. This is a little bit different.
Yeah, I agree with you. And Dave Weigel at the Washington Post has a piece today about how when Republicans do hold town halls, they misinform their constituents routinely and consistently. They make many false claims. They say that the American Health Care Act would not result in a reduction of insurance, et cetera, et cetera. So it is important that the record is being corrected out there. Let me ask you a final question before I let you go.
Yeah, I mean, you know, let's just look at Blum's town hall and things that he said. There was going to be no cuts to Medicaid.
Right.
And you know, I mean, people in the district, what do they think? They hear that from him. They hear some other person say there are cuts to Medicaid. You can't blame them for not knowing who to believe. So it's not. Look, I mean, I think a strategy of let's hold a Rose Garden party, drink some adult beverages, and go out and either avoid our districts or tell them things that aren't true, that may work for a short period of time. I don't think it's going to work for very long. These are very smart people, very informed people that at least I've been out talking to and hearing from.
Yes, I'm not sure. I mean, we have media siloing. People are increasingly surrounding themselves with like-minded people. It's difficult to break through the kind of partisan walls people put up around them these days. Let me ask you a final question before I let you go. This abomination of a bill has to go to the Senate. One would think that senators are watching the reaction to the House passage of the bill closely. Then again, on the other hand, Republicans are only defending 8 of the 33 seats that are up for re-election in 2018. So it's possible that many of them are less concerned than they might otherwise be about the consequences. What is your view?
Well, I think the analysis is right. I mean, what I try to remind people, and to put it in terms that people can relate to, is that your senator or congressman, in some respects, is no different from you in the sense that they have a boss. That boss, in the case of the Senate, is the Senate Majority Leader, Mitch McConnell. Mitch McConnell has a lot of power, as all bosses do. He can decide your committee assignments. He can decide whether you get your name on a bill that gets heard on the floor. He can help you fundraise, or he can not help you fundraise. So, look, we all have bosses, and it's very hard. And we have peers, and there's a lot of peers, and it's hard to go against who your peers are. You know, what I say in these town halls is I'd like to think we have another boss. The people who put our senators and Congress people in office,
right?
And so if they don't hear from people in their districts or in their state, they'd be right to that. You can expect them to follow the path of least resistance and support their boss on balance. Now, I think many of them know that this is a bad bill, and many of them are beginning to hear from their constituents, but they really need to hear from their constituents what I think is the following. We need you to speak up now, early. Don't equivocate. Don't say you'll wait for it. Don't say you'll see. Speak up now and say, I will not vote for anything that takes health care away from people and crushes Medicaid by 25%. If you say that now, all you need are two or three people to say that. That will change the entire course of the conversation. If you don't, then you put yourself in a position to be strong-armed later. And that's how Washington works, and that's why we need people to really be very explicit in what they want their senators to do.
Folks, speak out. Be explicit about what you want your senators to do. This is a crucial moment in our history. We can go one of two paths from here. Make sure that you are involved in doing what you need to do. Andy Slavitt, I want to thank you so much for taking the time. I know you're on the road. I really do appreciate it.
I'm going to thank you, Jeff. I'm going to self-promote my Twitter handle because I...
Okay, we appear to have lost Andy, but you should follow him on Twitter. I do. His Twitter handle is at A Slavitt, S-L-A-V-I-T-T. Stay tuned. We'll take a quick break and then come right back with Carolyn Isaacs.
I can't stop shaking.
Welcome back. I'm still Joshua Holland, and I'm joined now by Carolyn Isaacs. Carolyn is the program director for the American Friends Service Committee in Tucson, Arizona. Carolyn, welcome to Politics and Reality Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for taking the time. Carolyn has authored a series of reports about the private prison industry and immigrant detentions. The Obama Justice Department was moving away from private detentions, but the Trump regime reversed course on that back in February. And then this week, Attorney General Jeff Sessions announced, I don't know what you'd call it, I guess a renewed emphasis on the drug war with longer prison sentences. Were you at all surprised, given that there has been kind of an increasingly bipartisan consensus on prison reform?
It's utterly shocking, truly. Because not just a consensus, but a strong trend over years that is documented and proven to be working, right? So we have evidence-based practices in the states that are saving money, that are reducing recidivism, that are actually helping to protect communities. And to completely do an about-face on that and say, don't bother me with the facts, is astonishing.
It really is. And Carolyn wrote a report about how these private prison companies had been kind of seeing the way that the winds were blowing and were investing in all sorts of alternatives to incarceration. So halfway houses and ankle bracelet monitoring and all of these things. And here comes Jeff Sessions and says, we're just going to go back 25 years and pretend that this had not happened, that we had not had real revolution among the conservative movement, this coming together of liberals and conservatives from different perspectives, right? Because a lot of conservatives were concerned with the fiscal savings mm-hmm. that could be realized from prison reform, and here we go, we're just blowing it all up. It's very surprising to me, just because it flies in the face of where the right was moving for the last few years. And we had Stephen Tellis on, who wrote a book about that. Let me shift gears a little bit. You live near the U.S.-Mexican border. How close are you to the border?
We're about an hour away from the Nogales port of entry.
Okay, so we constantly hear politicians from both sides of the aisle, mostly Republicans, but not only, calling for ever more border security. And they paint the border region as this anarchistic, unguarded, no man's land where, you know, cats and dogs are living together. It's just crazy. What do people need to understand about the reality that you guys are dealing with down in that region?
Several things. I mean, one, of course, the most fundamental thing to understand is that borders are artificial, right? So essentially, I'm sitting in what was once Mexico.
Right.
And so there has always been migration. There has always been flow of labor, of people, of goods back and forth across this region. So to arbitrarily say that must end really flies in the face of, honestly, how economies work, much less how human beings have always behaved. So that's one. Two is that I struggle to imagine how we could have a more militarized border than we already have. In this area, you know, you can't drive 5 minutes without seeing a Border Patrol vehicle. You can't get anywhere near the border without going through some sort of checkpoint or seeing some sort of watchtower or seeing patrols going back and forth. I mean, there are plenty of boots on the ground down here. And so at a certain point, it's not unlike Sessions' announcement, right? It just flies in the face of common sense. It's in complete abstraction to what the facts are, right? Crime rates are at historic lows in this country, and border apprehensions here in the Tucson sector are also at historic lows, right? So we have plenty of officers there, but people aren't coming.
Right, right. And I want to step back. What you mentioned about these are very old transnational communities, right? Before there was a United mm-hmm. States, since long before there was a United States, you had people moving back and forth. You know, you can go to Juarez, Mexico. It's right over a footbridge from El Paso, Texas. And people live and work and have families on both sides of the border. That's not unusual, is it?
Not at all. Well, and here, really, another kind of interesting aspect is that we have Native American populations who are, you know, they have been here a long time before there were these borders. And so we have this artificial split between Native peoples. So the Yaqui, the Tohono O'odham, their land is across this border region and it now basically straddles it.
So am I right to say that this militarized border impacts American citizens as well as Mexican citizens and others, permanent residents from various places, right? This is not something that is just about immigration.
Oh, certainly not. If you have this constant law enforcement presence in your community, you're going to feel that no matter who you are. The checkpoints in particular have been opposed by local residents. You know, including like ranchers and people who are like, this is just like, I live here. I need to go to the store every day without getting, you know, in a line for 20 minutes to go through a checkpoint.
And there have been a lot of complaints about Border Patrol and ICE agents. Is there a sense of almost impunity?
There's a real concern, of course, because we are you know, some of these communities are very isolated, and particularly, you know, the concern is about profiling, right? So you may be, you know, a third, fourth generation American, but if you are brown skinned, right, and look Mexican, quote unquote, you're going to be stopped, you know, much more often, quite frankly, than, you know, someone with lighter skin. And that takes a toll on people.
And tell me about the culture of the Border Patrol, because I understand that they have, in order to expand their force dramatically, really dramatically, and I should take a step back and let listeners know that in 1994, we spent $550 million on Border Patrol, on border security. And in just over 20 years, that increased to around $18 billion. So that's a, my math isn't great. It's over a 30-fold increase in 20-some-odd years. And you think that a police force grows more or less along with its population, like an urban police force. Maybe they'd hire a couple of hundred officers if a law and order mayor were elected, but you don't have this huge, relatively rapid expansion. What does it mean, practically speaking, to have to recruit and train all these officers in a relatively short time?
Yeah, it's an interesting problem, right? Because it's kind of like prison guards in Arizona. We're sort of tapped out. If you wanted to do that job, you would already be doing it. And so I think they are having a difficult time. I've actually heard about, you know, recruitment fairs going on recently to try to reach out to folks to fill those incoming positions. It's not a fun job. And it's, but at the same time, in some of these rural areas of Arizona, it may be the only employment opportunity other
right.
than a prison.
Right.
You know, this is the economy that we've created through the priorities that we set in our public policy, right? That this is where the jobs are. The mines have closed. And pretty much all you've got is some form of law enforcement.
And Donald Trump has asked, I should say that they have repeatedly lowered their recruiting standards in order to expand their force to the size that they have. They're recruiting a lot of military veterans and not necessarily giving them the training that they need to differentiate between a combat zone and a domestic law enforcement job function.
Mm-hmm.
Donald Trump is requesting billions more in border security. What do you fear that that's going to look like? I mean, as you say, there's only so many spaces that you can put a Border Patrol officer, right? I mean, it's like, this is already a heavily militarized border. What happens if they do manage to sink another, I don't remember the figure, $8 billion a year into it?
I really have a hard time imagining it, frankly. Again, because I don't know where these people are going to come from. and what realistically are they going to do? Again, apprehensions are down. You know, that's partly because of the economy. That's partly because word's gotten out that Arizona is not a nice place
for
immigrants to hang out. And so, you know, it's this strange disconnect between the reality and just this sort of political posturing. This is optics. Like, I am tough on crime, therefore I will invest in expansions where they're not needed. And so, you know, that is extremely concerning because on the one hand, you might just have people standing around being extremely bored a lot of the time. But again, if you have folks that are not trained, if you have folks who maybe are coming out of a military service, maybe with some unaddressed issues from that experience, you're really setting the stage for some dangerous interaction.
Yes, you are. And the administration says that it is, and it is, I shouldn't give it too much credence because this was an attempt to deflect criticism from its immigration policies, but at least they claim that they are going to prioritize so-called criminal aliens. If you have this many new officers on the beat, does it seem credible to you that they could continue to prioritize those with criminal records? Or once you have those officers added to your ranks, aren't they going to have to do something like go out and do workplace raids?
Well, sure. I mean, how do you know who's a criminal alien when they're driving down the street?
Right.
You don't. And so you got to stop everybody. And, you know, there again leads to racial profiling. This leads to harassment of local communities. So, you know, the policy was to prioritize, you know, under Obama, the folks that truly are, you know, quote unquote, dangerous or, you know, have some sort of serious offense. That was already being done. And so that's not what we're hearing from this administration. This is, again, a rollback to just more enforcement. And so if there is more, that means net widening.
Yes, it does. Carolyn, I believe we're about out of time. Where can people read your report on the private prison industry moving into alternatives to incarceration?
All kinds of fun and depressing information is to be had on our website, which is www.afscarizona.org.
All right. You can also read my piece, Abuses on the Border. That was in the American Prospect last year. It actually quotes Carolyn. And that's at prospect.org. Carolyn Isaacs, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. I really do appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
I'd also like to thank Heather Digby Parton and Andy Slavitt. You can follow me on Twitter at Joshua Hall. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes or Podbean or SoundCloud or wherever else you can find it. You can send an email griping about the show to politicsandreality@gmail.com. I would also like to thank the good folks at Hullabaloo, Digby again, Crooks and Liars and Smirking Chimp for letting me host the show at their joints. Of course, I would like to thank all of you fine people for tuning in this week. Stay strong.